This is Chumash, Book of Shmos, second shir. Okay. Thank you. Okay, we're on page 295. So as we said at the end yesterday, when Pharaoh says to the midwives to kill all the newborn baby boys, that is not a matter of population control. You don't control the population by killing the males. You only can control the population by killing the females. So that's why Chazal say here that it had nothing to do with reducing the population, but he had a report from his astrologers that the Jewish savior was going to be born, which of course would be male, and therefore he was trying to kill him so he wouldn't be able to grow up and save the Jewish people. Now, fifteen. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, Shifra and Pua, he said, when you deliver the Hebrew women, see them on the birth stool. If it's a son, you're to kill him. If it's a daughter, she shall live. Some want to suggest here that it's not just two women. You're not talking about two women who birth all of the entire Jewish population. But they were the ones who were in charge of the institution of midwifery. Now, you understand that this is a difficult position to be put in because it's immediately verifiable whether you did it or not. If there are little boys running around, so then you know that they didn't fulfill the command. The midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt spoke to them. And they caused the boys to live. Now, that's a step beyond. He told them to kill the boys. To say they disobeyed would mean they didn't kill the boys. But they went further than that. They made sure that if there was any danger or any problem, that they actively made sure that the boys would live. King of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing that you've caused the boys to live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, now, it's not clear. Let me just check the Unclus translation here. Yeah. Because the Hebrew women are unlike the Egyptian women. They're experts. Before the midwife comes to them, they've given birth. What's their answer? He asks, why did you cause them to live? What's the answer? In other words, we didn't really. We didn't do that. But it wasn't really in our hands to stop it because we are more or less superfluous. When Jewish women give birth, the midwife is called in, you know, maybe to clean up or to check things afterwards, but they don't need it. And by the way, there are ancient cultures where, or primitive cultures even today, where women give birth in the fields while they're working, and there's no midwives to attend them, and they give birth, and somebody takes away the child, and they continue working. I mean, it's not the big deal that we make out of it today. Now, you learn something important here, I think. Pharaoh told them to commit a crime. They, in their fear of God, refused to commit the crime. When confronted, what did they do? They lied. They didn't brazen it out. They didn't say, listen, you're a criminal, you know, you're a vicious person, we don't do what people like that, we fear God, and God's the one who tells us what to do, and we only... They lied in order to avoid the confrontation. This is a principle you see over and over again in the Tanakh. Even though you are in the right, Sean, you're in the right, and you have every justification for what you're doing, there's a point of avoiding confrontation by creating a subterfuge instead of simply, as I said, bracing it out. God tells Samuel, I want you to go and anoint one of Yishai's sons, which turns out to be David in the end, as king. Samuel says to God, Saul is sitting in the palace. He thinks he's king. He hears this project. He's going to kill me. God doesn't say to Samuel, you're telling me? Remember, I'm God. I know that. I'm telling you to go anyhow. He doesn't say that to him. He says, I'll tell you what you do. Take an animal with you. Anybody asks you where you're going, tell them you're going to offer a sacrifice. And while you're in Beis Lechem, then you can go to Yishai's house and anoint one of his children as king. So there too, God himself is telling Samuel what to do. And God says, avoid the confrontation, create a subterfuge. So you have to know that this is a point of Jewish, practice, how to deal with confrontational situations. Even if you're representing God, you don't have to make a point of it in such a way as to throw it in the other person's face. You with me? I want to insert here a point which I could have made yesterday. The Jews went down to Egypt with how many people?
70.
Okay, there were wives also and everything else, but let's say 70 for the sake of discussion. How many were they when they left?
3 million.
Roughly 3 million. There were 600,000 men over the age of 20. And roughly 600,000 women over the age of 20, and lots of children. Especially if you think of an increasing population, then always the younger portion is more numerous than the older portion. How long were they there?
210
years. Is this an extravagant mathematical prodigy that you go from 70 to 210? To 70 to 3 million in 210 years?
What about the ones that died in the darkness?
Oh, I'm coming to that. Good, okay, you mentioned that. Let's put that in. If, as the Midrash says, 80% died in the darkness, then the population just before they left was? 15 million. So imagine going from 70 to 15 million in 210 years. Is that something which, without an extravagant miracle, is inconceivable? Well, one day, a number of years ago, quite a few years ago now, I sat down with a calculator and I decided to try it out. It turns out that if you assume that on the average, each person leaves behind 4.5 descendants, you can go from 70 to 3 million, I was doing 2.5 million in those days, 2.5 million, in 210 years. 210 years is 7 generations. Average generation is 30 years. It's quite surprising. Each person leaves behind 4.5 descendants on the average, which means the average family size is 9. That's large, but that's not an extravagant miracle. And if you want to make it to 12.5 million, which is the figure I was working with, then I did it. It turns out to require only 5.6. So you can imagine upping it to 3 into 15, it would be 5.8, 5.9. It's not talking about a gigantic difference. When you take the multiplying factor and raise it to the 7th power, and then multiply it times 70, you get a gigantic increase. Which means that the population increase, although it's certainly not what you expect infant mortality, you expect infertility among couples, right? You expect all sorts of things to interfere, but it's not an extravagant impossibility, like on the average, each woman having 500 children. It's not that at all. So that when Chazal say that women gave birth to six sextuplets, six at a time, they're not saying that on force of mathematical necessity. It's not that, well, if it wasn't that way, we can't explain how it became such a big population. We can explain it without them. But it did, in fact, happen miraculously. And that's just the measures recording a fact. But if you are, it just weighs you down to be responsible for such a gigantic increase. So if you sit down with a calculator, you see that you shouldn't be weighed down so terribly by the increase. Really? Okay. God benefited the midwives. The people increased, became very strong. And it was because the midwives feared God. He made them houses. Because Yocheved, who's the mother of Moses and Aaron, is therefore the mother of the house of the Levites and the priests. And Miriam is one of the ancestors of King David. So this is the Gemara in Sot, I think. Yeah. Okay. Next page. Pharaoh commanded his entire people, saying, every son that will be born, into the river shall you throw him, and every daughter you shall keep alive. Which boys is Pharaoh commanding should be killed?
Newborns.
Right. Newborns. Which newborns? What could the question mean? You're just assuming the answer. That's why.
It doesn't have to be Hebrew.
Right. He didn't say here, search out all the Jewish boys and make sure they get drowned. He's saying, kill them all. So that if there'll be any Jew, any newborns around, no one could say, oh, maybe that's an Egyptian one. Who says it's a Jewish one? That's how desperate he was. He really believed the astrologers that the Savior was going to be born, and he wanted to undo it at any cost. Now comes a good example of what in the Tanakh is a constant theme of irony. From the person's own measure designed to accomplish something, the exact opposite comes out. A man went from the house of Levi and he took a daughter of Levi.
Every Jewish son?
No, even the Egyptian ones.
So, what's the meaning?
He's
in the Egyptian?
Right. I mean, this is
not good.
Because his astrologers told him that a savior for the Jewish people is going to be born. Now, it wasn't forever. It wasn't for the next 10 years. It was some period of time, some period of months, where he said, I'm not going to, or a year, whatever it was. For some period of time where this was being carried out. And he said, I don't want to take any chances. So all the boys are going to be killed. As I pointed out, boys don't matter for population. Right? Only women matter for population. Okay. A man went from the house of Levi and took a daughter of Levi. Woman conceived and gave birth to a son. This is the birth of Moses. Now, this account of the birth of Moses is different from the birth, I think, of any of the major figures of the entire Tanakh. In what is it different? Abraham's not introduced this way, not Isaac, not Jacob, not Joseph, not David, Solomon, Gideon, whoever you want. Yeah? From the opposite point of view, not that what it mentions her conceiving. Doesn't say who his parents are. Doesn't say who his parents are. You never have that. A man from Levi went and took a woman from Levi, whoever they are, you know. It's no mystery who they are in this week's Parsha, Vayera. It gives the whole genealogy in great detail from Levi down to Moshe and Aaron. All the names, all the ages, everything. Here, when they're introduced first time into the text, parents are anonymous. What could be the message of that? This is a literary point. What is the text saying about Moses? By the time it traces his lineage, he's already standing before Pharaoh and negotiating with him. Say it a little better, right? In other words, he doesn't really come from a humble birth. But if you want to understand his development, don't put it onto his parents. Don't say Moses became what he became because he had great parents. That's not correct. He had great parents, no doubt that they contributed and so, but his greatness was due to his particular circumstances of growing up without reference to the input of his parents. That's a very strong statement. I think it's unique in the entire Tanakh. You don't have so-and-so was born without parents and then later, five chapters later, being told, and by the way, these are his parents. Okay. The woman conceived and gave birth to a son. She saw that he was good and she hid him for 3 months. So already here we're being told, listen, if she hadn't seen that she was good, then she wouldn't have been able to do this. But she saw he was good. And because she saw he was good, whatever that means, she saw he was good, that enabled her to hide him for 3 months. But not more than 3 months. After that, she couldn't hide him anymore, even though he was good. She could not hide him any longer. So she took a wicker basket and smeared it with clay and pitch, placed the child in it, placed him on the reeds on the bank of the river. Now what's going on here? What is she hiding him from? What has being good got to do with hiding him? And why is 3 months the amount of time that she could hide him, after which she couldn't hide him anymore? Right? Now, part of this you can answer. I know when you break it up into chapters the way we do, but if you understand this as a continuation of the previous, this is now a newborn Jewish male baby. And if there is a decree that all the Jewish male babies, or all the male babies in the whole kingdom, should be put to death, so of course he's in danger. In danger. Well, what would normally attract the attention of a newborn baby? They cry. You'll discover this someday, gentlemen. They cry, and they can wake you up in the middle of the night, and they have very healthy lungs. You know, they can't roll logs, and they can't weave carpets, but they can cry. Right? So, if he were a normal baby to cry, then she'd never be able to hide him. It would be public knowledge that she had a baby. But no, he was good. He was good. He didn't cry. So, that was a possibility of hiding him. Good, but now, why only 3 months? Now, the 3 months, I don't think you can answer on the basis of the text. Here, you must have the supplementation of the oral tradition, which is a good example of a principle that the written text needs oral supplementation. This is well known vis-a-vis law. Many, many laws cannot be understood without oral supplementation. It isn't as obvious, it isn't as well publicized, that it's true for narrative as well. Many, many stories have in them details which cannot be understood on the basis of the written text at all, unless you add in an oral supplementation. Here the Midrash tells us the following. The Egyptians had spies, and when a woman showed signs of pregnancy, which is usually the end of the third month, they kept records. And they noted it on a calendar. This woman is going to give birth in about 6 months. So, 6 months, or a little more than 6 months later, they would come back and they would check and see, did she give birth? And if so, what did she give birth to? So, Yocheved showed her signs of pregnancy, and they duly noted it on the calendar and made a resolution to come back in 6 months. Moses was born 3 months early. A greatly premature baby, beginning the 6th month. And, which would have been unusual for that time, though today is common enough, he was viable. So she said, he's not crying, so there's nothing to alert anyone that I gave birth early 3 months. So I have 3 months. But after 3 months, then the Egyptian overseers are going to come and check. Where's the baby? You were pregnant. And then I won't be able to hide him anymore. So she hid him for 3 months. By the way, once she gets rid of him, once she puts him in the river, she has no problem because it's obvious that she's not just postpartum. And she can say, I had a miscarriage. Right? So she's covered. Just a problem with him. What's she going to do with him? So she puts him in a basket at the edge of the river. I'll just mention to you a question my wife raised to me recently, very recently. Mustn't there be a connection here with the ark? If you look at the construction of the ark and the pitch that it was smeared with, it's very similar. You're saving someone from destruction. There's got to be a connection. My wife is very good at that. She makes connections of themes. I haven't had a chance to look up Mefarshim of what the connection means. I'm just mentioning it. That's a worthy subject. Okay. Puts her in by the river. Now the mother goes home. His sister stationed herself at a distance to know what would be done with it. What will happen to him? So, okay, not bad. Pharaoh's daughter went down to bathe by the river, and her maidens walked along the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent a maidservant that took it. She opened it and saw him, the child, and behold, the youth was crying. Now he's crying. All 3 months he wasn't crying. Now he's crying. She took pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrew boys. How would she know it's one of the Hebrew boys? So there are a few possibilities. Maybe the Jews look different from the Egyptians. Semitic stock that does look different from Egyptian stock. They didn't intermarry, so they could have preserved their natural features. Or if you say the decree was only against the Jewish newborn, so the very fact that he was put in a basket at the river means his mother was trying to save him. Or others say that she uncovered him and saw there was a bris milah, that he was circumcised. Whatever it is, she understands that this is one of the Hebrew boys. Now, she's she's Pharaoh's daughter. What do you expect her to do? Papa said they all have to die. That's what Papa said, right? You know, but he's crying. She has no children. So she's torn. I don't know whether adoption was a common thing in Egyptian society. Here's a baby. And she takes pity on him. And at that moment of pity, Miriam comes up, his sister, and said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and summon a wet nurse from the Hebrew women who will nurse the boy for you? And that's it. She can't resist. The daughter of Pharaoh said, go. The girl went to summon the boy's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this boy and nurse him for me, and I will give you a pay. So look at the irony here. Pharaoh makes a decree that the Jewish, at least the Jewish baby, should be killed. As it is, his daughter saves the baby. How did it get to his daughter? Only because it was the decree. And the decree meant that the mother put the baby in a basket up by the river. And that's when the daughter of Pharaoh saw him. And his own mother, Moses' own mother, nurses him for pay. And then the boy grew up, and she brought him to the daughter of Pharaoh, and he was a son to her. So now, Moses grows up in the palace. Something which, had there not been a decree to kill the Jewish newborns, would never have happened. Could never have happened. But no, because of the decree, Moses ends up growing up in the palace. She called the name Moses and said, I drew him from the water. Now I want to reflect on a number of things here. First of all, let's just think about it for a moment practically. This boy, who's now, How long did they suckle? In those days, it was common to suckle for years. There are cultures today where children can nurse till they're 5 or 6. And the Gemara talks about either 18 months or 2 years. How long was it then? It's hard to speculate. But he spent a good period of time in his own house growing up, Moses. Let's say till he was 3. Even today's bright Jewish children, by the time they're 3, are quite accomplished. Imagine Moses. Imagine a genius. He received a solid Jewish identity in his own home from his mother and father. That's why it isn't shocking that he ends up in the palace with Pharaoh, and he ends up feeling a brother to the Jews. That's not shocking, because he got it at the outset. Furthermore, when the 3 years are up and the boy is brought to the daughter of Pharaoh, that's not going to attract any attention. You know, how old is the kid? Well, the kid could be anything from 2 to 6. You know, kids are varying sizes, isn't it? Furthermore, Pharaoh's daughter. Take a guess. How many daughters do you think Pharaoh had?
Well, only one.
Huh? Only one daughter?
Lots.
He had lots of wives. He must have had hundreds of children. Right? You're talking about a whole population here. The fact that one of these hundreds of children ends up having a stepchild that she's taking care of, you know, who's keeping tabs of what these women do with their royal stipends? You know, they go floating down the Nile and buying trinkets at the fair, and who knows what they do? Talking about a rich empire, a man who's administering a whole empire. The fact that this doesn't attract attention is not terribly strikingly miraculous. You have to put it into the appropriate context. Well, I guess it depends upon how they went in those days. Whether the kids ran around naked, or whether they didn't run around naked. You know, if the kids were clothed, these are royal kids after all. Right? So if they went around clothed, then why should anybody notice it?
And you can't say you look Semitic.
Okay, it depends. It depends upon the variety of wives that Pharaoh had. Remember that marriages in those days were politically motivated. You married among the kingdoms that you had alliances with. Pharaoh, as a king, could have wives of many different complexions. So his children could be quite varied in their appearance.
Wasn't this particular daughter a convert? Isn't that why she was at the river?
Convert to what?
To the Jewish world, the same page.
Maybe she became afterwards. I don't think she was. That's fine. Maybe. Midrash is not my thing. I haven't studied it, and you very well know something that I'm not aware of. Okay, now, look at the description of the events on this page that we read. Chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. Notice that all the agents here in all of the action but one are women. There's only one thing the man does, and that is he makes his wife pregnant. After that, it's all women. It's his mother, it's his sister, it's the daughter of Pharaoh, it's the maiden to the daughter of Pharaoh. The whole background here is a feminine background. That's not an accident. That's not an accident. And Chazal go even further. Chazal say, well, let's put it into context. I'll show you where it comes from. There are 3 siblings, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. Who's the oldest?
Miriam.
Okay, I think it's Miriam, and then Aaron, and then Moses. He's the youngest. So what does it mean, a man went from the house of Levi, took a daughter of Levi, she conceived and gave birth to Moses? He's the youngest sibling. Just a little calculation. Now listen to what Chazal say. Chazal say, of course, Miriam and Aaron were born already. But the oppression was so bitter, and the decree to kill the newborn males was so bitter, that Amram, Moses' father-to-be, divorced his wife, whatever that meant in those days, to divorce, and all the other men following his leadership divorced their wives, because they said, we can't bring children into such a world. We're not going to have normal family life where half the children are going to end up murdered. Miriam fought with her father. She presented arguments against her father's decision. The Gemara preserves the arguments. And at the end of it, he admits that he was wrong, and he remarries Yocheved. This is what the Torah is talking about here when it says that this man from Levi and this woman from Levi got married. It really means they got remarried. Which means that the feminine background to Moses' existence goes even further. His sister Miriam is responsible for his becoming conceived, even. Because it was she who convinced her father to remarry her mother. Moses' whole foundation is a feminine foundation. I'm not going to explain that to you. It would go to sources that are too deep for us. But it's when you read something like this, and you see, painted a picture with a broad stroke brush, with one theme across the board, you have to say to yourself, the Torah is telling me something here. That his background is a solely feminine background. Furthermore, let me ask you another question. He was born 3 months before he was put in the river. And he had a bris milah. Did his parents give him a name? Sure, of course they gave him a name. The Gemara records the name or names that he was given. So then you want to ask, what happened to those names? Those are his real names. Those are his Hebrew names, the names that his parents gave him. His parents, you're talking about Amram and Yocheved. They gave him names. Aside from the oral tradition and maybe a couple of psukim and later Nach, they're not even mentioned. Who gives him the name that he's known to the whole world by, the name that carries throughout the entire Chumash? The daughter of Pharaoh. She gives him his name. Now that's quite astonishing. That means her input is enshrined and recorded forever. This woman, who in a way saved his life, she was at least the instrument for saving his life, she gives him his name, the name by which God calls him, the name by which we call him, forever. Which means that there's an input to his development from the outside. There's an input to his development from the outside. And this, too, is a very important theme. The Jewish people has to play a unique role in the world. And, as we said yesterday, insularity in their development is something which is important. That's why they were supposed to live in Goshen and to be isolated there. How do you develop a nation whose goal is to perfect the whole of the world, but to be uniquely the instrument for perfecting the whole of the world? No, there's no other instrument that can do that. Is it developed in connection to the rest of the world, or is it developed in isolation from the rest of the world? Here you see that the development is, to a great extent, in connection to and by taking from. By taking from, which means that what the Jewish people become is built out of elements that are taken from others. It's not something totally external that's injected from above. It's something that's built from below. The materials that were used to build the Mishkan, the tabernacle, where did they get them from? The gold, the silver, the copper, the tapestries, and all the rest. They took them from Egypt. The wood, says Jacob, planted them in Egypt so they'd be available to take out. They grew in the soil of Egypt. They took it out with them. The booty that they collected at the side of the sea when it coughed up the jewelry and the armor and the rest of the Egyptians. All that was used. So if you're going to perfect the whole of the world, the instrument to perfect it is made from the material of the world, not from something external and detached from the world, coming in from the outside. That's part of the theme here. The name, Moses' name, comes from the daughter of Pharaoh, the oppressor. Okay, and then water, another theme that my wife always points out. Water, in a way, is the enemy. When we did the Bereishis, I did this in great detail, but I'll just remind you briefly of a string of associations. The world is created covered with water, no place to live. Water has to be drawn off so that it can be human habitation. The great destruction is flood of water. When the Jews leave Egypt, there's a sea in the way. It has to be split. The water has to be split so the Jews can be freed. When they come into the land of Israel, they have to cross the Jordan River. It also has to be stopped so they can go across. Water has to be split, pushed aside, stopped in order for progress to be made. And in Psalms, it says that the sea wants to conquer the dry land. Do we need any better example of that than the tsunami we had 2 years ago? And the land at the edge of the sea holds the sea back. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu holds the sea back. So water is an element which has terribly destructive potential. And when it's used, so to say, contrary to its natural tendency to save, that in itself is a very striking event. Here, the water which was being used to kill the Jewish babies is the instrument for saving Moses' life. And then he later splits the water that stands in the way of the Jewish people so they can cross. And there's all one long theme. Okay, next page. Verse 11. It happened in those days that Moses grew up and went out to his brethren and observed their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew man of his brethren. Which phrase here is most important in this verse? Why is it the most important?
It emphasizes, I think, even when he has the opportunity to ignore what he sees and to be
okay.
Attached.
I'm sorry. Let me explain my question. When I ask a question like that, I mean it on the basis of the text. I'm not asking for your philosophical ruminations, of which everyone could have his own private feelings about it. I want to know what is the most important phrase in the verse. And prove it to me from something that's black and white on the text so that when you say it, everyone will have to say, oh, yes, he's right.
She's not assimilated.
Yeah, but that's a philosophical remark. And other people could say something else. He's sensitive to suffering. Who knows? You know, you can invent those things. You know, that's called armchair philosophizing. What's written on the page, it indicates... Yeah.
Of his brethren.
Why?
Because it's repeated.
Right. Of his brethren is the most important phrase because it's written twice. Twice in the same sentence. So as a text waving the flag, here's the essence. The essence is he regards them as his brethren. Number one. Now, what about his brethren? Where does it come in? He went out to his brethren and observed their burdens. Now, you don't get this in English, but in the Hebrew, it's bayar, Besivlosam. Vayar means to observe, to see, perceive. Sivlosam means their burdens, and then there's a base. It doesn't say Vayar es Sivlosam, which would be just a direct object. He saw their burdens. The eros be means to identify and to empathize. He went out to his brethren and empathized with their burdens. So the brethren here means it explains why the result was empathy, not just fact gathering, information gathering. I wonder how Egyptian structure is built. What supplies labor? Oh, look at that. There are those people. I wonder how big they are. I wonder where they live. I wonder what their hours are, you know, and what their history is. And just in gathering information about the empire, you know, a budding prince. Why shouldn't he know how the empire works? No, he went out to his brethren. And because he went out to his brethren, when he saw their burdens, he empathized. He empathized with their burdens. Number one. Then it says, he saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew man of his brethren. What does the repetition of his brethren there do there? Let me tell you something which became clear to me about 3 days ago. It takes a long time for some people. There's very, very little direct description of experience in the Torah. How did it feel? What did he think? What were his emotions? What were his associations when the actions take place? There's very little he thought, he felt. There's some, but comparatively little. But it's implied in the descriptions. He saw, now the text tells you, how did he see it? How did he see it? What was it for him when he saw it? He saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew man of his brethren. So, in his vision, there are three things. This guy's got the E. This guy's got the J. You know, this Egyptian, Jew. And this one has the capital B, brother! That's what he saw. Someone striking my brother. Imagine you are standing on the street and you see one person striking another and their backs are to you. And you think, oh, that's terrible. Look at that. I mean, what a crime. And you go up and you think, maybe I could stop it. Maybe I could. And then you suddenly discover when you walk around, where you catch sight of the faces, that the person being struck is your brother. Wouldn't that gigantically change the experience? What? My brother? So when it says of his brethren, it's filling in how he experienced it. It was an oppressor, you know, a taskmaster striking one of his brothers. Okay. Now, we're almost out of time.
Why does it avoid a direct description of oppressing his people?
You know, I don't know. I used to make the point that descriptions of feelings are sparse. It's just, as I say, it takes some. This took me over more than 40 years. I realized a few days ago that if you read descriptions, I usually read descriptions as reasons. When you say that A did something, all the elements in the description are reasons why he did it. That's true. Reasons is already internal. It's how he thinks about it. It's what his values are concerning it. I realized that a lot of it also triggers your understanding of the person's experience of it. Now, why it should be done this way or that way, that's a very deep question. You know, the truth is there are two different levels where you can ask, what does the text mean, which is one level, and then you can ask, why did the text choose to express that meaning with this verb, this type of language? That's a much deeper question, a much more difficult question. Usually I can't answer that question.
Maybe to make it more universal?
I don't know. But to answer that, you'd have to do a general study. You can't do it on the basis of one page. But these are the kinds of questions that should be asked. Anyway, he turned this way and that and saw there was no man. He struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. So, he was concerned with his safety here. He didn't blindly run and kill the Egyptian. But on the other hand, feeling that it was safe, so he took very drastic action. In other words, he identifies with his Jewish brethren to the extent that to hit a Jew, to cause a Jew to suffer, as a taskmaster would, to him was intolerable, period, to the extent of being willing to kill the taskmaster. I will go on from here to my position.
So why was Moshe called that?